for the mind and body for its own obscure purpose. There wasn't much visual imagery, just the naked sensation of exhilaration, until I began to picture myself on the back of a big black horse, galloping headlong down a path through a forest. I was perched up high on its shoulders like a jockey, holding on tight as the beast scissored its great muscles forward and back with each long stride. As my rhythm synced with that of the horse, I could feel myself absorbing the animal's power. It felt fantastic to so fully inhabit my body, as if for the first time. And yet, because I am not a very confident rider or dancer, it also felt precarious, as if were I to miss a breath or beat, I might tumble off. I had no idea how long the trance lasted. Time was utterly lost on me. But when Fritz gently brought me back to the present moment and the reality of the room, simply by encouraging me to slow and relax my breathing, he reported I had been in it for an hour and 15 minutes. I felt flushed and sweaty and triumphant, as if I had run a marathon. Fritz said I looked radiant, young like a baby. "You had no resistance," he said approvingly. "That's a good sign for tomorrow." I had no idea what had just happened, could recall little more of the hour than riding the horse, but the episode seemed to have involved a terrific physical release of some kind. Something had let go of me or been expunged, and I felt buoyant and humbled by the mystery of it. For here was, to quote William James, one of the forms of consciousness entirely different from the ordinary, and yet so close by, separated from normal waking consciousness by what? A handful of exhalations. Then something frightening happened. Fritz had gone up to the house to prepare our dinner, leaving me to make some notes about the experience on my laptop, when all at once I felt my heart surge and then begin to dance madly in my chest. I immediately recognized the sensation of turbulence as AFib, and when I took my pulse, it was chaotic. A panicky bird was trapped in my ribcage, throwing itself against the bars in an attempt to get out. And here I was, a dozen miles off the grid, smack in the middle of nowhere. It went on like that for 2 hours, straight through a subdued and anxious dinner. Fritz seemed concerned. In all the hundreds of breathwork sessions he had led or witnessed, he had never seen such a reaction. He had mentioned earlier a single fatality attributed to holotropic breathwork, a man who had had an aneurysm. Now I was worried about tomorrow, and I think he was too. Though he also wondered if perhaps what I was feeling in my heart might reflect some psychic shift or heart opening. I resisted the implied metaphor, holding firm to the plane of physiology. The heart is a pump, and this one is malfunctioning. We discussed tomorrow's plan. Maybe we want to go with a lower dose, Fritz suggested. You're so susceptible, you might not need very much to journey. I told him I might bail out altogether. And then, as suddenly as it had come on, I felt my heart slip back into the sweet groove of its accustomed rhythm. I got little sleep that night as a debate raged in my head about whether or not I was crazy to proceed in the morning with LSD at any dose. I could die up here, and wouldn't that be stupid? But was I really in any danger? Now my heart felt fine, and from everything I read, the effects of LSD were confined to the brain, more or less, leaving the cardiovascular system unaffected. In retrospect, it made perfect sense that a process as physically arduous as holotropic breathwork would discombobulate the heart. I subsequently learned that hyperventilation, which plays a role in breathwork, changes the CO2 levels of the blood, which in turn can alter the rhythms of the heart in some people. What I assumed was a physiologically benign alternative to MDMA turns out to be nothing of the kind. Even without a drug, it is possible to change one's blood chemistry in ways that can affect heart rhythms. Yes, I could take a rain check on my LSD journey, but even the thought of that option landed like a crushing disappointment. I had come this far, and I had had this intriguing glimpse into a state of consciousness that, for all my trepidations, I was eager to explore more deeply. This went on all night, back and forth, pro and con, but by the time the sun came up, the earliest rays threading the needles of the eastern pines, I was resolved. At breakfast, I told Fritz I felt good and wanted to proceed. We agreed, however, to go with a modest dose, 100 micrograms, with a booster after an hour or two if I wanted one. Fritz sent me out on a walk to clear my head and think about my intention while he did the dishes and readied the yurt for my journey. I hiked for an hour on a trail through the forest, which had been refreshed overnight by a rain shower. The cleansed air held the scent of cedar, and the barkless red limbs of the manzanita were glowing. Fritz had told me to look for an object to put on the altar. While I was looking and walking, I decided I would ask Fritz to give me his pledge that if anything whatsoever went wrong, he would call 911 for help, regardless of the personal risk. I returned to the yurt around 10 with a manzanita leaf and a smooth black stone in my pocket and a straightforward intention: to learn whatever the journey had to teach me about myself. Fritz had lit a fire in the wood stove and the room was beginning to give up its chill. He had moved the mattress across the room so my head would be close to the speakers. In somber tones, he talked about what to expect and how to handle various difficulties that might arise. Paranoia, spooky places, the feeling you're losing your mind or that you were dying. "It's like when you see a mountain lion," he suggested. "If you run, it will chase you, so you must stand your ground." I was reminded of the flight instructions that the guides employed at Johns Hopkins. Instead of turning away from any monster that appears, move toward it, stand your ground, and demand to know, "What are you doing in my mind? What do you have to teach me?" I added my stone and leaf to the altar, which held a bronze Buddha surrounded by the items of many previous travelers. "Something hard and something soft," Fritz observed. I asked for the assurances I needed to proceed and received them. Now he handed me a Japanese teacup, at the bottom of which lay a tiny square of blotter paper and the torn scraps of a second square, the booster. One side of the blotter paper had a Buddha printed on it, the other a cartoon character I didn't recognize. I put the square on my tongue and, taking a sip of water, swallowed. Fritz didn't perform much of a ceremony, but he did talk about the sacred tradition I was now joining, the lineage of all the tribes and peoples down through time and around the world who use such medicines in their rites of initiation. Here I was, in range of my 60th birthday, taking LSD for the first time. It did feel something like a rite of passage, but a passage to where exactly? While waiting for the LSD to come on, we sat on the wooden skirt of decking that circled the yurt, chatting quietly about this and that, life up here on the mountain, the wildlife that shared the property with him because he didn't keep a dog. There were mountain lions, bears, coyotes, foxes, and rattlesnakes. Jittery, I tried to change the subject. As it was, I'd been afraid during the night to visit the outhouse, choosing instead to pee off the porch. Lions and bears and snakes were the last thing I wanted to think about just now. Around 11, I told Fritz I was starting to feel wobbly. He suggested I lie down on the mattress and put on my eye shades. As soon as he started the music, something Amazonian in flavor, gently rhythmic with traditional instruments, but also nature sounds, rain showers and crickets, that created a vivid dimensional sense of outdoor space, I was off, traveling somewhere in my mind in a fully realized forest landscape that the music had somehow summoned into being. It made me realize what a powerful little technology a pair of eye shades could be, at least in this context. It was like donning a pair of virtual reality goggles, allowing me immediately to take leave of this place and time. I guessed I was hallucinating, yet this was not at all what I expected an LSD hallucination to be, which was overpowering. But Fritz had told me that the literal meaning of the word is to wander in one's mind, and that was exactly what I was doing, with the same desultory indifference to agency that the wanderer feels. Yet I still had agency. I could change at will the contents of my thoughts. But in this dreamy state, so wide open to suggestion, I was happy to let the terrain and the music dictate my path. And for the next several hours, the music did just that, summoning into existence a sequence of psychic landscapes, some of them populated by the people closest to me, others explored on my own. A lot of the music was New Age drivel, the sort of stuff you might hear while getting a massage in a high-end spa, yet never had it sounded so evocative, so beautiful. Music had become something much greater and more profound than mere sound. Freely trespassing the borders of the other senses, it was palpable enough to touch, forming three-dimensional spaces I could move through. The Amazonian tribal song put me on a trail that ascended steeply through redwoods, following a ravine notched into a hillside by the silvery blade of a powerful stream. I know this place. It was the trail that rises from Stinson Beach to Mount Tamalpais. But as soon as I secured that recognition, it morphed into something else entirely. Now the music formed a vertical architecture of wooden timbers, horizontals and verticals and diagonals that were being magically craned into place, forming levels that rose one on top of the other, ever higher into the sky like a multi-storied treehouse under construction, yet a structure as open to the air and its influences as a wind chime. I saw that each level represented another phase in my life with Judith. There we were, ascending stage by stage through our many years together, beginning as kids who met in college, falling in love, living together in the city, getting married, having our son Isaac, becoming a family, moving to the country. Now, here at the top, I watched a new, as yet inchoate stage being constructed, as indeed one now is. Whatever this life together is going to be now that Isaac has grown up and left home. I looked hard, hoping for some clue about what to expect, but the only thing I could see clearly was that this new stage was being built on the wooden scaffolding of earlier ones, and therefore promised to be sturdy. So it went song by song for hours. Something aboriginal, with a deep, spooky tone of a didgeridoo, put me underground, moving somehow through the brownish-black rootscape of a forest. I tensed momentarily. Was this about to get terrifying? Have I died and been interred? If so, I was fine with it. I got absorbed watching a white tracery of mycelium threading among the roots and linking the trees in a network intricate beyond comprehension. I knew all about this mycelial network, how it forms a kind of arboreal internet, allowing the trees in a forest to exchange information. But now what had been merely an intellectual conceit was a vivid felt reality of which I had become a part. When the music turned more masculine or martial, as it now did, sons and then fathers filled my mental field. I watched a swiftly unfolding biopic of Isaac's life to this point, his struggles as an exquisitely sensitive boy, and how those sensitivities had turned into strengths, making him who he is. I thought about things I needed to tell him, about the surging pride I felt as he embarked on his adult life and made his way in a new city and career, but also my fervent hope that he not harden himself in success or disown his vulnerabilities and sweetness. I felt something on my eye shades and realized I had wet them with my tears. I was already feeling wide open and undefended when it dawned on me that I wasn't talking to Isaac, or not only to him, but to myself as well. Something hard and something soft. The paired terms kept turning over like a coin. The night before coming to Fritz's place, I had spoken to 2,000 people in a concert hall, tracked across the stage by a spotlight, as I played the role of the man with the answers, the one people could depend on to explain things. This was much the same role I played in my family growing up, not only for my younger sisters, but in times of crisis for my parents, too. Even now, my sisters stubbornly refuse ever to accept from me the words, "I don't know." So now look at me, I thought, a smile blooming on my face, this grown man blindfolded and laid out on the floor of a psychedelic therapist yurt, chasing after my mind as it wandered heedlessly through the woods of my life, warm tears of what I didn't know sliding down my cheeks. This was unfamiliar territory for me and not at all where I expected to find myself on LSD. I hadn't traveled very far from home. Instead of the demons and angels and various other entities I was expecting to meet, I was having a series of encounters with the people in my family. I visited each of them in turn, the music setting the tone, and the emotions came over me in great waves, whether of admiration for my sisters and mother, whom I pictured seated around a horseshoe-shaped table like the UN, each of them representing a different ideal of feminine strength, or gratitude or compassion, especially for my father, a man both driven and pursued for much of his life, and someone whom, before this moment, I'd never before fully imagined as a son, and a son of ferociously demanding parents. The flood tide of compassion overflowed its banks and leaked into some unexpected places, like my fourth-grade music class. here I inexplicably encountered poor Mr. Roper, this earnest young man in a cheap suit who, in spite of heroic efforts, could not get us to give a shit about the sections of an orchestra he mapped on the board or the characters of the various instruments, no matter how many times he played Peter and the Wolf for us. As he paced the classroom in his excitement, we would wait in breathless suspense for him to step on one of the upturned thumbtacks we placed in his path, a thrill for which we were willing to risk staying after school in detention. But who was this Mr. Roper, really? Why couldn't we see that behind the cartoon figure we tortured so mercilessly was, no doubt, a decent guy who wanted nothing more than to ignite in us his passion for music? The unthinking cruelty of children sent a quick shiver of shame through me. But then, what a surfeit of compassion I must be feeling to spare that much for Mr. Roper. And cresting over all these encounters came a cascading dam break of love. Love for Judith and Isaac and everyone in my family. Love even for my impossible grandmother and her long-suffering husband. The next day, during our integration session, Fritz read from his notes two things I apparently said during this part of the journey. I don't want to be so stingy with my feelings, and all this time spent worrying about my heart, what about all the other hearts in my life? It embarrasses me to write these words. They sound so thin, so banal. This is a failure of my language, no doubt, but perhaps it is not only that. Psychedelic experiences are notoriously hard to render in words. To try is necessarily to do violence to what has been seen and felt, which is in some fundamental way pre- or post-linguistic, or, as students of mysticism say, ineffable. Emotions arrive in all their newborn nakedness, unprotected from the harsh light of scrutiny and especially the pitiless glare of irony. Platitudes that wouldn't seem out of place on a Hallmark card glow with the force of revealed truth. Love is everything. Okay, but what else did you learn? No, you must not have heard me. It's everything. Is a platitude so deeply felt still just a platitude? No, I decided. A platitude is precisely what is left of a truth after it has been drained of all emotion. To resaturate that dried husk with feeling is to see it again for what it is. The loveliest and most deeply rooted of truths, hidden in plain sight. A spiritual insight? Maybe so, or at least that's how it appeared in the middle of my journey. Psychedelics can make even the most cynical of us into fervent evangelists of the obvious. You could say the medicine makes you stupid, but after my journey through what must sound like a banal and sentimental landscape, I don't think that's it. For what, after all, is the sense of banality or the ironic perspective, if not two of the sturdier defenses the adult ego deploys to keep from being overwhelmed, by our emotions certainly, but perhaps also by our senses, which are liable at any time to astonish us with news of the sheer wonder of the world. If we are ever to get through the day, we need to put most of what we perceive into boxes neatly labeled known, to be quickly shelved with little thought to the marvels therein, and novel, to which, understandably, we pay more attention, at least until it isn't that anymore. A psychedelic is liable to take all the boxes off the shelf, open and remove even the most familiar items, turning them over and imaginatively scrubbing them until they shine once again with the light of first sight. Is this reclassification of the familiar a waste of time? If it is, then so is a lot of art. It seems to me there is great value in such renovation, the more so as we grow older and come to think we've seen and felt it all before. Yet 100 micrograms of LSD had surely not propelled me into the lap of God, as it had Leo Zeff, even after the booster, another 50 micrograms, which I was eager to take in hopes of going deeper and longer. I never achieved a transcendent, non-dual, or mystical-like experience, and as I recapped the journey with Fritz the following morning, I registered a certain disappointment. But the novel plane of consciousness I'd spent a few hours wandering on had been interesting and pleasurable and, I think, useful to me. I would have to see if its effects endured, but it felt as though the experience had opened me up in unexpected ways. Because the acid had not completely dissolved my ego, I never completely lost the ability to redirect the stream of my consciousness or the awareness it was in fact mine. But the stream itself felt distinctly different, less subject to will or outside interference. It reminded me of the pleasantly bizarre mental space that sometimes opens up at night in bed when we're poised between the states of being awake and falling asleep, so-called hypnagogic consciousness. The ego seems to sign off a few moments before the rest of the mind does, leaving the field of consciousness unsupervised and vulnerable to gentle eruptions of imagery and hallucinatory snatches of narrative. Imagine that state extended indefinitely, yet with some ability to direct your attention to this or that, as if in an especially vivid and absorbing daydream. Unlike a daydream, however, you are fully present to the contents of whatever narrative is unfolding, completely inside it and beyond the reach of distraction. I had little choice but to obey the daydream's logic, its ontological and epistemological rules, until, either by force of will or by the fresh notes of a new song, the mental channel would change and I would find myself somewhere else entirely. This, I guess, is what happens when the ego's grip on the mind is relaxed but not eliminated, as a larger dose would probably have done. For the moment, that interfering neurotic who, in waking hours, tries to run the show was blessedly out of the way, as Aldous Huxley put it in The Doors of Perception. Not entirely out of the way, in my case, but the LSD had definitely muffled that controlling voice, and in that lightly regulated space, all sorts of interesting things could bubble up, things that any self-respecting ego would probably have kept submerged. I had had a psycholytic dose of LSD, one that allowed the patient to explore his psyche in an unconstrained but still deliberate manner while remaining sufficiently combobulated to talk about it. For me, it felt less like a drug experience. The LSD feels completely transparent, with none of the physiological noise I associate with other psychoactive drugs, than a novel mode of cognition falling somewhere between intellection and feeling. I had conjured several of the people closest to me, and in the presence of each of them had come stronger emotions than I had felt in some time. A dam had been breached, and the sensation of release felt wonderful. Two, a few genuine insights had emerged from these encounters, like the one about my father as a son, which turned on an act of imagination, of empathy, that even grown children seldom have sufficient distance to perform. During our integration session, Fritz mentioned that some people on LSD have an experience that in content and character is more like MDMA than a classic psychedelic trip. Maybe what I had had was the MDMA session I'd had to pass up. The notion of a few years of psychotherapy condensed into several hours seemed about right, especially after Fritz and I spent that morning unpacking the scenes from my journey. As I steered my rental car down the mountain and toward the airport for the flight home, I was relieved that the experience had been so benign. I had survived, had roused no sleeping monsters in my unconscious, and grateful it had been productive. All that day and well into the next, a high-pressure system of well-being dominated my psychological weather. Judith found me unusually chatty and available. My usual impatience was in abeyance, and I could outlast her at the table after dinner, being in no hurry to get up and do the dishes so I could move on to the next thing and then the next thing after that. I guessed this was the afterglow I'd read about, and for a few days it cast a pleasantly theatrical light over everything, italicizing the ordinary in such a way as to make me feel uncommonly appreciative. It didn't last, however, and in time I grew disappointed that the experience hadn't been more transformative. I had been granted a taste of a slightly other way to be, less defended, I would say, and so more present. And now that I had acquainted myself with the territory and returned from this first foray more or less intact, I decided it was time to venture farther out. Trip 2, Psilocybin. My second journey began around an altar in the middle of a second-story loft in a suburb of a small city on the eastern seaboard. The altar was being prayed over by an attractive woman with long blonde hair parted in the middle and high cheekbones that I mention only because they would later figure in her transformation into a Mexican Indian. Seated across the altar from me, Mary's eyes were closed as she recited a long and elaborate Native American prayer. She invoked in turn the power of each of the cardinal directions, the four elements, and the animal, plant, and mineral realms, the spirits of which she implored to help guide me on my journey. My eyes were closed too, but now and again I couldn't resist peeking out to take in the scene. The squash-colored loft with its potted plants and symbols of fertility and female power, the embroidered purple fabric from Peru that covered the altar, and the collection of items arrayed across it, including an amethyst in the shape of a heart, a purple crystal holding a candle, little cups filled with water, a bowl holding a few rectangles of dark chocolate, the two sacred items she had asked me to bring, a bronze Buddha a close friend had brought back from a trip to the East, the psilocybin coin Roland Griffiths had given me at our first meeting, and squarely before me, an antique plate decorated in a grandmotherly floral pattern that held the biggest psilocybin mushroom I had ever seen. It was hard to believe I was about to eat the whole thing. The crowded altar also held a branch of sage and a stub of Palo Santo, a fragrant South American wood that Indians burn ceremonially, and the jet black wing of a crow. At various points in the ceremony, Mary lit the sage and the Palo Santo, using the wing to smudge me with the smoke, guide the spirits through the space around my head. The wing made an otherworldly whoosh as she flicked it by my ear, the spooky sound of a large bird coming too close for comfort, or a dark spirit being shooed away from a body. The whole thing must sound ridiculously hokey, I know, but the conviction Mary brought to the ceremony, together with the aromas of the burning plants and the sounds of the wing pulsing the air, plus my own nervousness about the journey in store, cast a spell that allowed me to suspend my disbelief. I had decided to give myself up to this big mushroom, and for Mary, the guide to whom I had entrusted my psyche for this journey, ceremony counted for as much as chemistry. In this, she was acting more like a shaman than a psychologist. Mary had been recommended by a guide I'd interviewed on the West Coast, a rabbi who had taken an interest in my psychedelic education. Mary, who was my age, had trained with the 80-something student of Timothy Leary, whom I had interviewed and decided was a little too far out there for me. One might think the same of Mary on paper, but something about her manner, her sobriety, and her evident compassion made me more comfortable in her presence. Mary had practiced the whole grab bag of New Age therapies, from energy healing to spiritual psychology to family constellation therapy, before being introduced to medicine work when she was 50. Family constellation therapy, which was founded by a German therapist named Bert Hellinger, focuses on the hidden role of ancestors in shaping our lives and works to help us make peace with these ghost-like presences. Mary said that medicine work had created the glue that brought together all this other work I'd been doing. At the time, Mary had used a psychedelic only once and long ago, at her 21st birthday party while in college. A friend had given her a jar of honey laced with psilocybin mushrooms. Mary immediately went up to her room, ate two or three spoonfuls, and, she said, had the most profound experience of being with God. I was God, and God was me. Friends who had been partying downstairs came up to knock at her door, but Mary was gone. As a child growing up outside Providence, Mary had been an enthusiastic Catholic, until I realized I was a girl, a fact that would disqualify her from ever performing the ceremonies she cherished. Mary's religiosity lay dormant until that taste of honey, which catapulted me into a huge change, she told me the first time we met. I dropped into something I hadn't felt connected to since I was a little girl. The reawakening of her spiritual life led her onto the path of Tibetan Buddhism and eventually to take the vow of an initiate. To assist all sentient beings in their awakening and their enlightenment, which is still my vocation. And now sitting before her in her treatment room was me, the next sentient being on deck, hoping to be wakened. I shared my intention to learn what I could about myself and also about the nature of consciousness, my own, but also its transpersonal dimension, if such a dimension exists. The mushroom teacher helps us to see who we really are, Mary said, brings us back to our soul's purpose for being here in this lifetime. I can imagine how these words might sound to an outsider, but by now I was inured to the New Age lingo, perhaps because I had glimpsed the potential for something meaningful behind the well-worn words. I'd also been impressed by Mary's intelligence and her professionalism. In addition to having me consent to the standard agreements, bowing to her authority for the duration, remaining in the room until she gave me permission to leave, no sexual contact, and so on, she had me fill out a detailed medical form, a legal release, and a 15-page autobiographical questionnaire that took me the better part of a day to complete. All of which made me feel I was in good hands, even when those hands were flapping a crow's wing around my head. Yet as I sat there before the altar, it seemed doubtful I could choke down that whole mushroom. It had to be 5 or 6 inches long with a cap the size of a golf ball. I asked her if I could crumble it into a glass of hot water, make a tea, and drink it. "Better to be fully conscious of what you're doing," she said, "which is eating a mushroom that came from the earth one bite at a time. Examine it first closely, then start at the cap." She offered me a choice of honey or chocolate to help get it down. I went with the chocolate. Mary had told me that a friend of hers grows the psilocybin and had learned the craft years ago in a mushroom cultivation workshop taught by Paul Stamets. It seems there is only 1 or 2 degrees of separation between any two people in this world. On the tongue, the mushroom was dry as the desert and tasted like earth-flavored cardboard, but alternating each bite with a nibble of the chocolate helped. Except for the gnarly bit at the very base of the stipe, I ate all of it, which amounted to 2 grams. Mary planned to offer me another 2 grams along the way for a total of 4. This would roughly approximate the dose being given to volunteers in the NYU and Hopkins trials and was equivalent to roughly 300 micrograms of LSD, twice as much as I had taken with Fritz. We chatted quietly for 20 minutes or so before Mary noticed my face was flushed and suggested I lie down and put on eye shades. I chose a pair of high-tech black plastic ones, which in retrospect might have been a mistake. The perimeters were lined with soft black foam rubber, allowing the wearer to open his eyes to pitch darkness. Called the Mindfold Relaxation Mask, Mary told me, it had been expressly designed for this purpose by Alex Gray, the psychedelic artist. As soon as Mary put on the first song, a truly insipid New Age composition by someone named Thierry David, an artist thrice nominated, I would later learn, in the category of Best Chill Groove Album, I was immediately propelled into a nighttime urban landscape that appeared to have been generated by a computer. Once again, sound begat space. In the beginning was the note, I remember thinking, with a sense of profundity. And what I took to be Thierry's electronica conjured a depopulated futuristic city with each note forming another soft black stalagmite or stalactite that together resembled the high-relief soundproofing material used to line recording studios. The black foam forming this high-relief landscape, I realized later, was the same material lining my eye shades. I moved effortlessly through this digital nightscape as if within the confines of a video game dystopia. Though the place wasn't particularly frightening, and it had a certain sleek beauty, I hated being in it and wished to be somewhere else, but it went on seemingly forever and for hours with no way out. I told Mary I didn't like the electronic music and asked her to put on something else, but though the feeling tone changed with the new music, I was still stuck in this sunless computer world. Why, oh why, couldn't I be outside, in nature? Because I had never much enjoyed video games, this seemed cruel, an expulsion from the garden, no plants, no people, no sunlight. Not that the computer world wasn't an interesting place to explore. I watched in awe as one by one musical notes turned into palpable forms before my eyes. Annoying music was the presiding deity of this place, the generative force. Even the most spa-appropriate New Age composition had the power to spawn fractal patterns in space that grew and branched and multiplied to infinity. Weirdly, everything in my visual field was black, but in so many different shades that it was easy to see. I was traversing a world generated by mathematical algorithms, and this gave it a certain alienated, lifeless beauty. But whose world was it? Not mine. And I began to wonder, whose brain am I in? Please, not Thierry David's. This could easily take a terrifying turn, it occurred to me, and with that, a dim tide of anxiety began to build. Recalling the flight instructions, I told myself there was nothing to do but let go and surrender to the experience. Relax and float downstream. This was not at all like previous trips, which had left me more or less the captain of my attention, able to direct it this way or that and change the mental channel at will. No, this was more like being strapped into the front car of a cosmic roller coaster, its heedless, headlong trajectory determining moment by moment what would appear in my field of consciousness. Actually, this is not completely accurate. All I had to do was remove my eye shades and reality, or at least something loosely based on it, would reconstitute itself. This is what I now did, partly to satisfy myself that the world was still existing, but mostly because I badly had to pee. Sunlight and color flooded my eyes, and I drank it in greedily, surveying the room for the welcome signifiers of non-digital reality. Walls, windows, plants. But all of it appeared in a new aspect, jeweled with light. I realized I should probably put on my glasses, which partly domesticated the scene, but only partly. Objects continued to send their sparkles of light my way. I got up carefully from the mattress, first onto one knee, then unsteadily onto my feet. Mary took me by the elbow, geriatrically, and together we made the journey across the room. I avoided looking at her, uncertain what I might see in her face or betray in mine. At the bathroom door, she let go of my elbow. Inside, the bathroom was a riot of sparkling light. The arc of water I sent forth was truly the most beautiful thing I had ever seen, a waterfall of diamonds cascading into a pool, breaking its surface into a billion clattering fractals of light. This went on for a pleasant eternity. When I was out of diamonds, I went to the sink and splashed my face with water, making sure not to catch sight of myself in the mirror, which seemed like a psychologically risky thing to do. I made my unsteady way back to the mattress and lay down. Speaking softly, Mary asked if I wanted a booster. I did, and sat up to receive it. Mary was squatting next to me, and when I finally looked up into her face, I saw that she had turned into Maria Sabina, the Mexican curandera who had given psilocybin to R. Gordon Wasson in that dirt basement in Huautla de Jimenez 60 years ago. Her hair was black. Her face, stretched taut over its high cheekbones, was anciently weathered, and she was wearing a simple white peasant dress. I took the dried mushroom from the woman's wrinkled brown hand and looked away as I chewed. I didn't think I should tell Mary what had happened to her. Later, when I did, she was flattered. Maria Sabina was her hero. But there was something I needed to do before putting my eye shades back on and going back under, a little experiment I had told Mary I wanted to perform on myself during my trip. I wasn't sure if in my condition I could pull it off, but I'd found that even in the middle of the journey, it was possible to summon oneself to a semblance of normality for a few moments at a time. Loaded on my laptop was a brief video of a rotating face mask used in a psychological test called the binocular depth inversion illusion. As the mask rotates in space, its convex side turning to reveal its concave back, something remarkable happens. The hollow mask appears to pop out to become convex again. This is a trick performed by the mind, which assumes all faces to be convex and so automatically corrects for the seeming error. Unless, as a neuroscientist had told me, one was under the influence of a psychedelic. This autocorrect feature is a hallmark of our perception, which in the sane adult mind is based as much on educated guesswork as the raw data of the senses. By adulthood, the mind has gotten very good at observing and testing reality and developing confident predictions about it that optimize our investment of energy, mental and otherwise, and therefore our survival. So rather than starting from scratch to build a new perception from every batch of raw data delivered by the senses, the mind jumps to the most sensible conclusion based on past experience combined with a tiny sample of that data. Our brains are prediction machines optimized by experience, and when it comes to faces, they have boatloads of experience. Faces are always convex, so this hollow mask must be a prediction error to be corrected. These so-called Bayesian inferences, named for Thomas Bayes, the 18th century English philosopher who developed the mathematics of probability on which these mental predictions are based, serve us well most of the time, speeding perception while saving effort and energy, but they can also trap us in literally preconceived images of reality that are simply false, as in the case of the rotating mask. Yet it turns out that Bayesian inference breaks down in some people. Schizophrenics and, according to some neuroscientists, people on high doses of psychedelic drugs, neither of whom see in this predictive or conventionalized manner. Nor do young children who have yet to build the sort of database necessary for confident predictions. This raises an interesting question. Is it possible that the perceptions of schizophrenics, people tripping on psychedelics, and young children are, at least in certain instances, more accurate, less influenced by expectation, and therefore more faithful to reality than those of sane and sober adults? Before we started, I had queued up the video on my laptop, and now I clicked to run it. The mask on the screen, gray against a black ground, was clearly the product of computer animation and was uncannily consistent with the visual style of the world I'd been in. During my integration session with Mary the next day, she suggested that it might have been this image on my laptop that had conjured the computer world and trapped me in it. Could there be a better demonstration of the power of set and setting? As the convex face rotated to reveal its concave back, the mask popped back out, only a bit more slowly than it did before I ate the mushroom. Evidently, Bayesian inference was still operational in my brain. I'd try again later. When I put my eye shades back on and lay down, I was disappointed to find myself back in computer world, but something had changed, no doubt the result of the stepped-up dose. Whereas before I navigated this landscape as myself, taking in the scene from a perspective recognizable as my own, with my attitudes intact, highly critical of the music, for instance, and anxious about what demons might appear, now I watched as that familiar self began to fall apart before my eyes, gradually at first and then all at once. I now turned into a sheaf of little papers, no bigger than Post-its, and they were being scattered to the wind. But the I taking in this seeming catastrophe had no desire to chase after the slips and pile my old self back together. No desires of any kind, in fact. Whoever I now was fine with whatever happened. No more ego? That was okay. In fact, the most natural thing in the world. And then I looked and saw myself out there again, but this time spread over the landscape like paint or butter, thinly coating a wide expanse of the world with a substance I recognized as me. But who was this I that was able to take in the scene of its own dissolution? Good question. It wasn't me exactly. Here the limits of our language become a problem. In order to completely make sense of the divide that had opened up in my perspective, I would need a whole new first-person pronoun. For what was observing the scene was a vantage and mode of awareness entirely distinct from my accustomed self. In fact, I hesitate to use the I to denote the presiding awareness. It was so different from my usual first-person. Where that self had always been a subject encapsulated in this body, this one seemed unbounded by any body, even though I now had access to its perspective. That perspective was supremely indifferent, neutral on all questions of interpretation, and unperturbed even in the face of what should by all rights have been an unmitigated personal disaster. Yet the personal had been obliterated. Everything I once was and called me, this self 6 decades in the making, had been liquefied and dispersed over the scene. What had always been a thinking, feeling, perceiving subject based in here was now an object out there. I was paint. The sovereign ego, with all its armaments and fears, its backward-looking resentments and forward-looking worries, was simply no more. And there was no one left to mourn its passing. Yet something had succeeded it. This bare disembodied awareness, which gazed upon the scene of the self's dissolution with benign indifference. I was present to reality, but as something other than myself. And although there was no self left to feel exactly, there was a feeling tone, which was calm, unburdened, content. There was life after the death of the ego. This was big news. When I think back on this part of the experience, I've occasionally wondered if this enduring awareness might have been the mind at large that Aldous Huxley described during his mescaline trip in 1953. Huxley never quite defined what he meant by the term, except to speak of the, quote, totality of the awareness belonging to mind at large, but he seems to be describing a universal, shareable form of consciousness unbounded by any single brain. Others have called it cosmic consciousness, the oversoul, or a universal mind. This is supposed to exist outside our brains as a property of the universe, like light or gravity, and just as pervasive, constitutive, too. Certain individuals, at certain times, gain access to this awareness, allowing them to perceive reality in its perfected light, at least for a time. Nothing in my experience led me to believe this novel form of consciousness originated outside me. It seems just as plausible, and surely more parsimonious, to assume it was a product of my brain, just like the ego it supplanted. Yet this by itself strikes me as a remarkable gift, that we can let go of so much, the desires, fears, and defenses of a lifetime, without suffering complete annihilation. This might not come as a surprise to Buddhists, transcendentalists, or experienced meditators, but it was sure news to me, who has never felt anything but identical to my ego. Could it be there is another ground on which to plant our feet? For the first time since embarking on this project, I began to understand what the volunteers in the cancer anxiety trials had been trying to tell me, how it was that a psychedelic journey had granted them a perspective from which the very worst life can throw at us, up to and including death, could be regarded objectively and accepted with equanimity. Actually, this understanding arrived a little later, during the last part of my psilocybin trip, when the journey took a darker turn. After spending an unknown number of hours in computer world, for time was completely lost on me, I registered the desire to check back in on reality and to pee again. Same deal, Mary guided me to the bathroom by the elbow, geriatrically, and left me there to produce another spectacular crop of diamonds. But this time, I dared to look in the mirror. What looked back at me was a human skull, but for the thinnest, palest layer of skin stretched over it, tight as a drum. The bathroom was decorated in a Mexican folk art theme, and the head skull immediately put me in mind of the Day of the Dead. With its deep sockets and lightning bolt of veins zigzagging down its temple on one side, I recognized this ashen head skull as my own, but at the same time as my dead grandfather's. This was surprising, if only because Bob, my father's father, is not someone with whom I ever felt much in common. In fact, I loved him for all the ways he seemed unlike me, or anyone else I knew. Bob was a preternaturally sunny and seemingly uncomplicated man, incapable of thinking ill of anyone or seeing evil in the world. His wife Harriet amply compensated for his generosity of spirit. Bob had a long career as a liquor salesman, making the weekly rounds of the nightclubs in Times Square for a company that everyone but he knew was owned by the mob. Upon reaching the age I am now, he retired to become a painter of lovely, naive landscapes and abstractions in spectacular colors. I'd brought one of them with me to Mary's room, along with a watercolor of Judas. Bob was a genuinely happy, angst-free man who lived to be 96, his paintings becoming ever more colorful, abstract, and free toward the end. To see him so vividly in my reflection was chilling. A few years before, visiting Bob in the nursing home in the Colorado desert where he would soon die, I'd watched what had been a fit and vigorous man, it had been his habit to stand on his head every day well into his 80s, contract into a parenthesis of skin and bones marooned in a tiny bed. The esophageal muscles required to swallow had given out, and he was tethered to a feeding tube. By then, his situation was pitiful in so many respects, but for some reason I fixed on the fact that never again would a taste of food ever cross his lips. I splashed cold water on our joint face and made my unsteady way back to Mary. Risking another glance at her, this time I was rewarded by the sight of a ravishing young woman, blonde once again, but now in the full radiance of youth. Mary was so beautiful, I had to look away. She gave me another small mushroom, gram number 4, and a piece of chocolate. Before I put on my eye shade, I attempted to conduct the rotating mask test a second time, and it was a complete bust, neither confirming or disproving the hypothesis. As the mask began to rotate, gradually bringing its backside into view, the whole thing dissolved into a gray jelly that slid down the screen of my laptop before I could determine whether the melting mask I was watching was convex or concave. So much for conducting psychological experiments while tripping. I put on my eye shades and sank back down into what now became a cracked and parched desert landscape dense with artifacts and images of death. Bleached skulls and bones and the faces of the familiar dead passed before me, aunts and uncles and grandparents, friends and teachers and my father-in-law, with a voice telling me I had failed to properly mourn all of them. It was true. I had never really reckoned the death of anyone in my life. Something had always gotten in the way. I could do it here and now, and did. I looked hard at each of their faces, one after another, with a pity that seemed bottomless, but with no fear whatsoever. Except once, when I came to my Aunt Ruth Ellen and watched, horrified, as her face slowly transformed into Judith's. Ruth Ellen and Judith were both artists, and both had been diagnosed with breast cancer around the same time. The cancer had killed Ruth Ellen and spared Judith. So what was Judith doing down here among the unmourned dead? Had I been defending myself against that possibility all this time? Heart wide open, defenses melting, the tears began to flow. I've left out one important part of my journey to the underworld, the soundtrack. Before going back under for this last passage, I had asked Mary to please stop playing spa music and put on something classical. We settled on the second of Bach's unaccompanied cello suites performed by Yo-Yo Ma. The suite in D minor is a spare and mournful piece that I'd heard many times before, often at funerals, but until this moment, I had never truly listened to it. Though listen doesn't begin to describe what transpired between me and the vibrations of air set in motion by the 4 strings of that cello. Never before has a piece of music pierced me as deeply as this one did now. Though even to call it music is to diminish what now began to flow, which was nothing less than the stream of human consciousness, something in which one might glean the very meaning of life, and if you could bear it, read life's last chapter. A question formed, why don't we play music like this at births as well as funerals? And the answer came immediately, there is too much life already lived in this piece, and poignancy for the passing of time that no birth, no beginning, could possibly withstand it. 4 hours and 4 grams of magic mushroom into the journey, this is where I lost whatever ability I still had to distinguish subject from object, tell apart what remained of me and what was Bach's music. Instead of Emerson's transparent eyeball, egoless and one with all it beheld, I became a transparent ear, indistinguishable from the stream of sound that flooded my consciousness, until there was nothing else in it, not even a dry, tiny corner in which to plant an eye and observe. Open to the music, I became first the strings, could feel on my skin the exquisite friction of the horsehair rubbing over me, and then the breeze of sound flowing past as it crossed the lips of the instrument and went out to meet the world, beginning its lonely transit of the universe. Then I passed down into the resonant black well of space inside the cello, the vibrating envelope of air formed by the curves of its spruce roof and maple walls. The instrument's wooden interior formed a mouth capable of unparalleled eloquence, indeed of articulating everything a human could conceive. But the cello's interior also formed a room to write in and a skull in which to think, and I was now it, with no remainder. So I became the cello and mourned with it for the 20 or so minutes it took for that piece to, well, change everything, or so it seemed. Now, its vibrations subsiding, I'm less certain. But for the duration of those exquisite moments, Bach's cello suite had had the unmistakable effect of reconciling me to death. To the deaths of the people now present to me, Bob's and Ruth Ellen's and Roy's, Judith's father's, and so many others, but also to the deaths to come and to my own, no longer so far off. Losing myself in this music was a kind of practice for that, for losing myself, period. Having let go of the rope of self and slipped into the warm waters of this worldly beauty, Bach's sublime music, I mean, and Yo-Yo Ma's bow caressing those four strings suspended over that envelope of air, I felt as though I'd passed beyond the reach of suffering and regret. That was my psilocybin journey, as faithfully as I can recount it. As I read those words now, doubt returns in full force. Fool, you were on drugs. And it's true. You can put the experience in that handy box and throw it away, never to dwell on it again. No doubt this has been the fate of countless psychedelic journeys that their travelers didn't quite know what to do with or failed to make sense of. Yet though it is true that a chemical launched me on this journey, it is also true that everything I experienced, I experienced. These are the events that took place in my mind, psychological facts that were neither weightless nor evanescent. Unlike most dreams, the traces these experiences inscribed remain indelible and accessible. The day after my journey, I was glad for the opportunity to return to Mary's room for a couple of hours of integration. I hoped to make sense of what happened by telling the story of my trip and hearing her thoughts about it. What you've just heard is the result and the beneficiary of that work, for immediately after the journey, I was much more confused by it than I am now. What now sounds like a reasonably coherent narrative highlighting certain themes began as a jumble of disjointed images and shards of sense. To put words to an experience that was in fact ineffable at the time, and then to shape them into sentences and then a story, is inevitably to do it a kind of violence. But the alternative is literally unthinkable. Mary had taken apart the altar, but we sat in the same chairs, facing each other across a small table. 24 hours later, what had I learned? That I had had no reason to be afraid. No sleeping monsters had awakened in my unconscious and turned on me. This was a deep fear that went back several decades to a terrifying moment in a hotel room in Seattle, when, alone and having smoked too much cannabis, I had had to marshal every last ounce of will to keep myself from doing something deeply crazy and irrevocable. But here in this room, I had let down my guard completely, and nothing terrible had happened. The serpent of madness that I worried might be waiting had not surfaced or pulled me under. Did this mean it didn't exist, that I was psychologically sturdier than I believed? Maybe that's what the episode with Bob was all about. Maybe I was more like him than I knew, and not nearly as deep or complicated as I like to think. Can a recognition of one's shallowness qualify as a profound insight? Mary wasn't so sure. You bring a different self to the journey every time, she said. The demons might rouse themselves the next time. That I could survive the dissolution of my ego without struggle or turning into a puddle was something to be grateful for. But even better was the discovery that there might be another vantage, one less neurotic and more generous, from which to take in reality. That alone seems worth the price of admission, Mary offered, and I had to agree. Yet, 24 hours later, my old ego was back in uniform and on patrol. So what long-term good was that beguiling glimpse of a loftier perspective? Mary suggested that having had a taste of a different, less defended way to be, I might learn, through practice, to relax the ego's trigger-happy command of my reactions to people and events. Now you have had an experience of another way to react, or not react. That can be cultivated. Meditation, she suggested, was one way to do that. It is, I think, precisely this perspective that had allowed so many of the volunteers I interviewed to overcome their fears and anxieties, and in the case of the smokers, their addictions. Temporarily freed from the tyranny of the ego, with its maddeningly reflexive reactions and its pinched conceptions of one's self-interest, we get to experience an extreme version of Keats's negative capability. The ability to exist amid doubts and mysteries without reflexively reaching for certainty. To cultivate this mode of consciousness with its exceptional degree of selflessness, literally, requires us to transcend our subjectivity, or, it comes to the same thing, widen its circle so far that it takes in, besides ourselves, other people, and beyond that, all of nature. Now I understood how a psychedelic could help us to make precisely that move, from the first person singular to the plural and beyond. Under its influence, a sense of our interconnectedness, that platitude, is felt, becomes flesh. Though this perspective is not something a chemical can sustain for more than a few hours, those hours can give us an opportunity to see how it might go, and perhaps to practice being there. I left Mary's loft in high spirits, but also with the feeling I was holding on to something precious by the thinnest, most tenuous of threads. It seemed doubtful I could maintain my grip on that outlook for the rest